course, and myself personally, stand ready, of course, to render any assistance we can to assist you in the accomplishment of your mission.
I can't think of anything I need right now, sir.
MacArthur looked at him for a long moment, then nodded his head.
If something comes up, let me know.
Thank you, General. Again, Fleming, I deeply appreciate your loyalty to me. But if there's nothing else?
No, sir. Thank you for seeing me, sir.
3. Naval Air Transport Command Passenger Terminal, United States Naval Base, Pearl Harbor, Oahu, Territory of Hawaii. 14:30 hours, 21 November, 1942. The plump, bland-faced officer, his desk plate identified him as Lieutenant J.G. L.B. Cavanaugh, USNR, Officer in Charge, Passenger Seat Assignment, was simply a typical bureaucrat who had put on a uniform for the duration plus 6 months, Major James C. Brownlee III, USMCR, thought impatiently. It was not at all hard for Brownlee to picture Lieutenant Cavanaugh standing behind the Pan American Airways ticket counter in Miami, offering the same argument he was offering here.
I'm sorry, I don't make the regulations, and I have no authority to change them.
Lieutenant Cavanaugh had produced the rules with all the self-righteous assurance of Moses presenting the Ten Commandments on his descent from Mount Sinai.
Here they are, God has spoken, there is no room for argument.
U.S. Navy Base, Pearl Harbor, TH Circular 42-2, Standing Operating Procedure, Naval Air Transport Command Passenger Terminal, consisted of 16 mimeographed pages, each protected by a celluloid envelope in a blue loose-leaf binder. From its battered condition, Brownlee concluded that the lieutenant had found it necessary to produce the regulations frequently. Section 6, Conflicting Priorities, took 2 single-spaced typewritten pages to deal with the inevitability of 2 or more people showing up at the same time with, on the face of it, similar priorities to claim 1 seat. The point was that priorities were really seldom absolutely identical, although Lieutenant J.G. Cavanaugh was willing to grant that the priorities of Major Brownlee and Captains Sessions and Macklin were more nearly identical than was usually the case. All 3 carried the highest 6A priority classification. Some time ago, Lieutenant J.G. Cavanaugh said, a 6A priority would almost have guaranteed a seat on any plane going anywhere. But that had changed, as various headquarters realized the only way to be sure their travelers got on airplanes with the least possible delay was to issue them the highest priority possible. In consequence of that, authority to issue 6A air travel priorities had been removed from lesser headquarters. At the present time, only Commander U.S. Naval Activities West Coast, ComNav Act West, Commander U.S. Naval Activities East Coast, ComNav Act East, SINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific, and SWEPO, Supreme Headquarters Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, had the authority to issue 6A air travel priorities. Plus, of course, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff and the Chief of Naval Operations. Identical 6A priorities issued by the Chief of Staff of the Army and the Chief of Naval Operations had priority over 6A priorities issued by lesser headquarters. But inasmuch as the 6A priorities issued to Major Brownlee and Captains Sessions and Macklin had all been issued by the Chief of Naval Operations, that was no help in determining who would occupy the 1 seat available on the Coronado departing Pearl Harbor at 16:15 hours for Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, Brisbane, Australia. The next selection criteria, given identical 6A priorities issued by the same or equal level headquarters, was the date and time of the issue. And this was the deciding factor here, Lieutenant J.G. Cavanaugh announced. Inasmuch as the 6A priority issued to Captain Sessions was dated 4 days prior to the 6A priorities issued to Major Brownlee and Captain Macklin, Captain Sessions was thus entitled to the seat. Lieutenant
J.G. Kavanaugh, was deaf to Major Brownlee's argument that the three officers were all on the same mission, that he was, by virtue of his rank, the commanding officer, and thus had the authority to determine which of the three would travel first, with the others to follow. "Priorities are not transferable," Lieutenant J.G. Kavanaugh said. Paragraph 14B, he indicated with his finger the applicable paragraph.
"Lieutenant," Sessions asked, "what if I was suddenly taken ill? It really is important that Major Brownlee reaches Brisbane before I do." "You would really have to be sick," Lieutenant J.G. Kavanaugh said. "Otherwise, that would constitute absence without leave with the intention of avoiding hazardous duty. All air travel beyond here into the Pacific is considered hazardous duty. They'd take you to the dispensary, and you would have to prove you were sick."
He flipped the pages of Standard Operating Procedure until he came to the applicable paragraph, then held out the blue loose-leaf binder for them to see for themselves.
"And I can't just voluntarily give up my seat to Major Brownlee?" Sessions asked.
"No, you cannot," Lieutenant J.G. Kavanaugh said simply but firmly.
"Have a nice flight, Ed," Major Brownlee said. "I'll see you in Brisbane." "I'm sorry, sir," Ed Sessions said.
"It's not your fault," Brownlee said. "This has all come down from Mount Sinai, graven on stone." Sessions chuckled.
"I'll tell you what you might do, Major, if it's really important that you get to Brisbane," Lieutenant J.G. Kavanaugh said.
"It's really important.
You might go out to Hickam Field. The Army's running flying fortresses through there to Australia. Sometimes they can find a ride for people in a hurry. There's no seats on a B-17, of course, and it's a long ride."
"How would I get from here to Hickam Field?"
"There's a bus from the main gate. I think they run every hour on the quarter hour."
"You mind getting on the Coronado by yourself, Ed?" Brownlee asked. "Can you handle all that stuff by yourself?"
He pointed to their luggage. In addition to their clothing, this included the obsolete device cryptographic M94, the new crypto device, which to Sessions' surprise did not seem to have an official nomenclature, four small portable shortwave radios and several spare sets of batteries, and other items which Colonel Rickaby and Major Banning decided, before Brownlee and Macklin showed up, that McCoy might find useful. Sessions took Brownlee's meaning. While Brownlee might be able to cajole space for himself and Macklin on a flying fortress, it was unlikely the Army Air Corps would be willing to carry along several hundred pounds of what looked like his personal baggage.
"I can handle it," Sessions said, and then looked at Lieutenant J.G. Kavanaugh to see if he had any objections.
"Let me see your orders again," Kavanaugh said.
He studied them carefully, then announced,
"No problem. Paragraph 5B says, and such equipment and accessories as is considered necessary for the accomplishment of the assigned mission. I presume all that stuff is necessary."
"Absolutely," Brownlee and Sessions said at the same instant. They looked at each other and chuckled. Then Brownlee put out his hand.
"See you in Brisbane, Ed," he said.
"Yes, sir."
Macklin offered his hand. Sessions pretended not to see it.
But he saw it. Sessions refused to shake Macklin's hand. And since we reported to management analysis, he hasn't said one word to him that was not absolutely necessary. I wonder what that's all about. Resentment that we're going in on what these people thought was their mission? That doesn't sound likely, but there's something.
4. Headquarters, Marine Air Group 21, Marine Airfield, Iwa, Oahu Island, Territory of Hawaii, 22 November 1942. Lieutenant Colonel Clyde W. Dawkins, USMC, noticed the staff car parked at the wooden base operations building when he passed over the field on the downwind leg of his approach. Dawkins, a tanned, wiry man of 35, who was a career Marine out of Annapolis, commanded MAG 21.
"Now what?" he asked rhetorically, somewhat disgustedly and aloud, and then turned most of his attention to putting the Grumman F-4 Wildcat fighter onto the ground.
He took a closer look at the staff car as he taxied past base ops. It was a nearly new Buick special sedan, and thus was engaged in the transportation of not only a brass hat, but a senior brass hat. There were only a couple of Buicks in the hands of Marines in Hawaii, and they were, rank hath its privileges, reserved for general officers.
Dawkins searched his mind, but could come up with no reason why a general officer would show up at Ewa on Sunday, unless he was either the bearer of bad tidings or really enraged about something and wished to make his displeasure known personally and immediately to the commanding officer of MAG 21. Dawkins taxied the Wildcat to a sandbag revetment, turned it around so it could be pushed backward into the revetment after refueling, shut it down, and then turned to the paperwork. It had been a test flight, following 100-hour maintenance, and he had found several items that needed either investigation or repair. He was aware that someone had climbed onto the wing route, but didn't look up.
"I didn't know they let worn-out old men like you play with hot airplanes like this," a male voice said, causing him to look up into the face of a large-boned, ruddy-faced man in his 40s. Without realizing he was doing it, truly a Pavlovian reflex, Dawkins raised his right hand to his eyelid in a salute and simultaneously tried to stand up. The uniform of the man standing on Dawkins' wing was adorned with both the golden wings of a naval aviator and the silver stars, one on each epaulette and one on each collar point, of a brigadier general.
"I think you have to take the harness off before you can do that," Brigadier General D.J. McInerney, USMC, said innocently as he sort of patted Dawkins' shoulder.
"Yes, sir," Dawkins said, chagrined. "Thank you very much, sir."
General McInerney jumped off the wing, then waited until Dawkins unstrapped himself and climbed out of the cockpit. As Dawkins joined him, he extended his hand.
"Good to see you, sir," Dawkins said.
"I thought you were in Washington." "I got in a couple of hours ago," McInerney said. "How's things, Doc?" "There's a lot more creature comforts around here," he said.
The last time they were in each other's company, they'd been in a tent at a paved-with-pierced-steel planking airstrip called Fighter One on the island of Guadalcanal in the Solomons.
"Do you know General Forrest, Doc?"
"I know who he is, sir."
"Intelligence," McInerney said. "An old friend. He knew I was coming here and asked me to do what I could about, this."
He dipped into the pocket of his tunic again and handed Dawkins a flimsy, carbon copy of an internal USMC memorandum. Telephone memorandum. Classification, none. Date and time, 1625, 16 November 1942. From Commandant USMC to Major General Forrest. Subject, Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman, Ernest. Synopsis. 1. The Commandant has received from SecNave personally SecNave's desire that Gunnery Sergeant Ernest Zimmerman, serial number unknown, USMC, presently assigned VMF 229, be immediately transferred to USMC Special Detachment 16 with duty station Brisbane, Australia. 2. The Secretary desires that Sergeant Zimmerman's travel to Brisbane be by the most expeditious means, and that he be advised by special channel communication of Sergeant Zimmerman's estimated time of arrival in Brisbane. The Secretary further desires that the commanding officer, USMC Special Detachment 16, be similarly advised, also by special channel communication. 3. The Commandant desires that Major General Forrest personally accomplish the foregoing as a matter of the highest priority.
"What I would like to do at any time within the next 15 minutes, Doc," General McInerney said, "is send a message to General Forrest telling him that Gunny Zimmerman is on his way to Brisbane."
Dawkins looked distinctly uncomfortable.
"Sir, he's not here."
"Where is he?"
"I think he's on Guadalcanal."
"You think he's on Guadalcanal?"
"Sir, he didn't leave the canal when the ground personnel got on the ship."
"Why not?"
"I think Captain Galloway is carrying him as being on temporary duty with the 2nd Raider Battalion."
"You don't know?"
"Big Steve had him. Zimmerman's a Browning expert. Transferred from the Raiders to VMF 229 when they were having weapons trouble. When the squadron was relieved, Zimmerman went back to the Raiders."
"Without orders?"
"I believe it was on Galloway's verbal orders, sir, with official orders to follow when that became possible."
"Where did you say Galloway is?"
"At Mukumuku, sir."
"Where's that?"
General McInerney asked, and then, before Dawkins could reply, went on, "You know where to find it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Get in the car, Colonel," General McInerney ordered. "Curiosity overwhelms me."
A silver-haired, elderly, dignified black man in a crisp white steward's coat walked out onto the flagstone patio of the sprawling mansion on the coast. 500 yards down the steep, lush slope, large waves crashed onto a wide, white sand beach. 3 people were on the patio, stretched comfortably out on upholstered rattan chaise lounges under a green awning. 1 was a statuesque, Slavic-appearing blonde woman in her 40s. Makeupless, pale-skinned, she had her blonde hair piled upward on her head. She was wearing a loose-fitting, gaudily flowered dress called a mumu. Her feet were in woven leather sandals. 1 of the men, a good-looking, slim, deeply tanned and brown-haired young man of 26, was wearing swimming trunks and a loose-fitting shirt quite as loud as the lady's mumu. The other, a large, nearly bald, barrel-chested man in his 40s, was wearing stiffly starched marine khakis, the collar unbuttoned. The collar points held the gold and brown bar of a master gunner, and there were gold naval aviator's wings on his chest.
"Captain Galloway," the steward said. "Colonel Dawkins is here to see you, with another gentleman, a general."
"Denny," Charlie Galloway said, "I've had a bad week. Do not pull my leg."
The steward raised his right hand, palm outward, to shoulder height, as if swearing that he was telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
"God, Denny, let them in," Galloway said, rising to his feet. "It wouldn't hurt to bow or something."
Smiling, the steward bowed with great dignity.
"Not to me, not to me, the general."
"Your wish is my command," Denny said.
"My God," the woman said, anguished. "Look at me."
20 seconds later, Brigadier General D.J. McInerney and Lieutenant Colonel Clyde W. Dawkins walked onto the patio. The master gunner came to a position very much like attention.
"Good afternoon, sir,"
Galloway said.
"Ah, Captain Galloway," McInerney said. "And Mr. Oblensky."
"Good afternoon, sir," Oblensky said formally. "Marine Corps legends in their own time," McInerney went on. "Why am I not surprised to find you two in such an environment of primitive squalor?"
"General, I don't believe you know Mrs. Oblensky," Galloway said.
"No, but I am genuinely honored to meet you, Commander," General McInerney said, then walked to her and shook her hand.
When she was not playing the role of Mrs. Master Gunner Oblensky, USMC, she was Commander Florence Kokarski, Chief Surgical Nurse, U.S. Navy Hospital, Pearl Harbor. She had been awarded the Silver Star for her valor, with absolute disregard for her own life, going aboard a sinking battleship to treat the wounded on December 7, 1941.
"Commander, how's the Secker boy doing?" McInerney asked.
"He's a long way from well, sir," she said. "But considering the shape he was in when we got him, he's doing fine."
"I saw the crash," McInerney said. "It wasn't pleasant."
"Steve told me," she said.
"That's another item on my agenda," McInerney said. "When can I see him?"
She smiled. "They generally waive visiting hours for general officers, General."
"I meant, when would it be convenient for you and your people?"
"Any time would be fine, sir."
"His father and I are old friends," McInerney said. "We were in France together in the last war, and so, incidentally, was our host."
"May I offer the general something to drink?" Galloway asked.
"Hawaiian hospitality, right?" McInerney said. "Goes with a rope of flowers around your neck. Second time today I've had that offer. Colonel Dawkins offered me something to drink, pineapple juice and gin. I was about to accept, and then the colonel told me you'd put Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman on TDY to the 2nd Raider Battalion. And I thought I'd hold off until I heard all about that."
"I'm surprised you heard about that, sir," Galloway said.
"Not as surprised as the Secretary of the Navy is going to be," McInerney said, and handed Galloway the telephone memorandum he had shown Dawkins at Iwa.
Galloway read it and handed it to Oblensky, who read it and winced.
"Permission to speak, sir?"
"Certainly, Mr. Oblensky," McInerney said. "The captain really didn't know much about this," Oblensky said. "I was mostly responsible for this, sir."
"I'm so carried away with old Lang Syne I may cry," McInerney said.
"Zimmerman was a raider before we got him, sir," Galloway said. "He came to me when we were relieved on the canal and said he wanted to go back to the raiders. I told him to go ahead, I'd fix the paperwork later."
"And why didn't you?" McInerney said.
"I tried, sir," Galloway said. "I ran into a couple of problems.
Be specific, Charlie. I'm fascinated. Sir, the personnel officer at Marine Barracks, Pearl Harbor, told me the only way to get Zimmerman into the Raiders was for Zimmerman to apply for them. I couldn't apply for him. They have to be volunteers.
Did you tell him Zimmerman was already running around behind the Jap lines on Guadalcanal with the Raiders?
I didn't think that would be a wise course of action under the circumstances, sir. McInerney chuckled.
So you just decided to sit tight and see what happened?
Yes, sir.
Something was bound to happen, right?
I'm sorry the Secretary of the Navy got involved, sir, and that you did, sir.
So am I, McInerney said. I'd love to stay here and have several strong drinks, Charlie, McInerney said. But I have to go find a message center so I can send a radio to General Forrest telling him that Gunny Zimmerman is running around Guadalcanal somewhere.
Sir, you can call him from here if you like, Charlie said.
Call as in telephone call, Charlie?
The Pacific and Far East Shipping Company office in Honolulu has a dedicated line to their office in San Francisco.
And you can use it? McInerney asked incredulously.
Galloway walked to the wall of the patio and returned with a telephone on a long cord. He dialed a number. "This is Captain Galloway," he said. "Would you put me through to San Francisco, please?" He handed the phone to General McInerney.
Part 11. 1. Naval Air Transport Station, Brisbane, Australia, 0625 hours, 24 November, 1942. The storm struck as the consolidated PB2Y3 Coronado made its final approach. They'd had bad weather all along the route from Hawaii, and their takeoff from the refueling stop at Midway Island was delayed for over 2 hours by weather. As Captain Edward Sessions, USMC, saw the flashes of lightning, heard the rain drumming on the fuselage, felt the huge plane being buffeted by strong winds, and saw the white caps on the water, he thought it entirely likely that having flown literally close to halfway around the world, he was about to get killed on landing. It had been a long trip. It was 2,269 miles from Washington to San Diego, 2,606 miles from San Diego to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and 4,702 from Pearl Harbor to Brisbane, with the refueling stop at Midway Island. The landing itself was a series of crashes against the water. When they finally stopped, the Coronado rocked sickeningly from side to side as the pilot taxied it as close as he dared to the shoreline. The storm seemed to worsen by the minute. A little train of open whaleboats started out through the choppy waters to the Coronado. It required great boat-handling skill to transfer the passengers and cargo, with the exception of the boxes Sessions was carrying, mostly mailbags, into the whaleboats without permitting the boats to crash against the thin aluminum of the seaplane. By the time the whaleboats made it from the seaplane to the shore, all the passengers were soaked through. On the face of the quay itself, there was a flight of narrow stone steps onto which the passengers had to jump from the bobbing whaleboats. Sessions was amazed that no one fell into the water, and that he finally managed to heave his personal luggage and the boxes onto the steps without losing anything. He surveyed the boxes, decided the one carrying the obsolete M94 cryptographic device and its replacement was the most valuable, picked it up, and carried it up the stone stairs. A Marine, a very young one, wearing an army poncho and a rain-soaked khaki fore and aft cap, walked up to him and saluted.
Captain Sessions, sir?
Right.
Staff Sergeant Coughler, sir. If you'll point out your gear, sir, I'll take care of it. General Pickering's over there, sir.
He pointed to two cars, a Studebaker President and a Jaguar convertible.
Everything that's on those steps, Sergeant. Thank you, Sessions said, and headed toward the Studebaker.
He was halfway there before his tired mind slipped into gear.
Staff Sergeant? Is that what he said? That boy is a Staff Sergeant? And what did he say his name was? Coughler? That's the kid who's been living like an animal under the noses of the Japs on Buka?
As he came close to the Studebaker, the rear door opened and he stepped in. Brigadier General Fleming W. Pickering extended his hands to take the box from him.
"Hello, Ed. How was the flight?" Pickering said.
"About like that, sir," Sessions said, waving a hand at the rough water. "Most of the way from Midway."
A hand was thrust at him, and Sessions took it before he saw that it was attached to First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, USMCR.
"Welcome to sunny Australia," McCoy said.
"If it hasn't melted, I have a letter, actually a little package from Ernie for you," Sessions said.
"Give it to him now," Pickering said. "You have to go back out in the rain. You're going to be staying with us, which means that you and McCoy will go in the Jaguar to the house while George and I take our guests to the Sweepo BOQ."
"They're not here, sir. They should be on tomorrow's plane, unless Major Brownlee was able to scrounge a ride on an Air Corps B-17. He was going to try."
"Not that I'm not glad to see you, Ed, but how is it the Major waited while the Captain got to fly?"
"I tried to give him my seat, sir, but the Navy wouldn't let me."
"You hear that, George?"
"Yes, sir."
"Drive up to Kaufler and tell him to bring Captain Sessions' stuff to the house."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Hello, George," Sessions said. "Congratulations on your promotion."
"If I thought I deserved it, Captain, I'd say thank you."
"You wouldn't have it if it wasn't deserved," Sessions said.
Hart started the engine, drove to the edge of the quay, and waited for Kaufler to appear. Then he rolled down the window.
"Kaufler, nobody else is coming. Bring all of Captain Sessions' gear out to the house."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Sessions waited until they were underway, then said,
"I can't believe that kid is Kaufler."
"Don't let that baby face fool you," McCoy said. "He's one hell of a Marine."
"Speaking of Marines," Pickering said, "what do you think of the two OSS Marines?"
"The Major's all right. Nice guy, bright, got his head screwed on correctly, speaks perfect Spanish."
"And the Captain?"
"The Captain is named Macklin," Sessions said evenly.
"Not,"
McCoy said. "One and the same, Lieutenant McCoy."
"Shit,"
McCoy said. For a moment, Pickering was confused. He was also somewhat surprised at the deep bitterness of McCoy's obscenity. And then he remembered hearing Jack Stecker and McCoy talking about an officer named Macklin. There had been some trouble with him in China, where Banning sided with McCoy against him, and again in Quantico, where Macklin tried to keep McCoy from getting commissioned.
"Is this the same officer you and Jack Stecker were talking about, Ken?" Pickering asked. "The one who gave you trouble on the rifle range at Quantico?"
"I'm still hoping Sessions is pulling my chain," McCoy said. "He has a strange sense of humor."
"I wish I was kidding about this, Ken," Sessions said. "General, this is the officer, using the term very loosely, with whom McCoy and I and Major Banning had trouble in China."
"Does Banning know it's the same man? More important, does Colonel Rickaby?"
Sessions went into his tunic and came out with a soggy envelope.
"Colonel Rickaby asked me to give you this, sir," he said.
It was a glossy photograph of the abrupt note Secretary Knox had sent Rickaby. After he read it, his first reaction was that Knox must have written it in anger, and that was uncharacteristic of him.
Was Knox boiling because Rickaby had the audacity to object to this man, Macklin? Or is there something else?
Well, Frank Knox can tell Rickaby he doesn't desire any further discussion of this, but he can't tell me that. Just as soon as we get to the house, I'll call Pluto in the dungeon and tell him to send Knox a special channel personal. If Banning, Sessions, and McCoy all think this man is no good, so far as I'm concerned, it's three strikes and he's out.
May I keep this, Ed? Pickering asked politely.
Of course, sir.
Let me think about this.
By the time they reached Water Lily Cottage, he'd had time to control his temper, consider his options, and choose one. It was so simple that he was a little afraid of it. He decided to say nothing now. He'd ask a few more questions and have a couple of cups of coffee and a cigar before finally making up his mind.
"Did I understand you to say, Ed, that Major Brownlee strikes you as a competent officer?" Pickering asked conversationally.
"Yes, sir, first class. And he impressed Colonel Rickaby the same way, sir."
"Really?"
"Yes, sir," Sessions said.
"We had a hurry-up briefing session with some Philippine experts from ONI, and the colonel sat in on it. He quickly came to the same conclusion I did, that Brownlee should have been the briefer rather than the briefee. The colonel told me to find out who in G1 had sent Major Brownlee to OSS instead of to us and have him shot."
"That good, eh?" Pickering chuckled.
"Fascinating."
Captain Ed Sessions had heard references to the cottage, so he was not surprised when Hart pulled the Studebaker up against the veranda of a rambling frame house, and Pickering announced, "Here we are, Ed, our home away from home." But he was surprised at the size of the place, and then even more surprised when the rear door of the Studebaker was pulled open by a plump, gray-haired, motherly woman in her late 50s who was wearing a flowered dress and a frilly apron. She held an enormous umbrella over her head.
"Welcome to Australia, Captain Sessions," she said, and thrust two more umbrellas into the back seat.
Pickering sensed Sessions' surprise.
"Captain Sessions, this is Mrs. Horace Cavendish," he said, laughter in his voice. "She's in charge around here. You disobey her at your peril."
Inside Waterlily Cottage, Sessions found that a hotel-like buffet of scrambled eggs, sausages — "They call those bangers, Ed," McCoy offered helpfully — "ham, and three kinds of biscuits and toast was laid out in a large dining room."
"God, war is hell, isn't it?" Sessions asked. "Since I went through boot camp," Pickering said solemnly, "I have always disagreed with the Marine Corps belief that you need practice to be miserable and hungry."
Over breakfast, Pickering explained that when he first came to Australia, MacArthur's SWEPO headquarters was in Melbourne.
"So I rented a house," he said, "presided over by Mrs. Cavendish. By the time El Supremo moved his headquarters here, Mrs. Cavendish had concluded that if it were not for her, all of us, in unwashed clothing and needing haircuts, would die of starvation in unmade beds. So she signed on for the duration and came up here when I rented this place."
"Some people have all the luck," Sessions said.
"She has a husband and two sons in the service," Pickering went on, the timbre of his voice changing. "One each, Royal Australian Army, Navy, and Air Force, all in Africa."
"Oh," Sessions said.
When he finished his breakfast, Pickering lit a cigar and then somehow summoned Mrs. Cavendish. Sessions heard the dull ring of a bell and decided there must be a button on the dining room table, or else the floor.
"Can I bring something else, General?"
Mrs. Cavendish asked.
"Would you please make a fresh pot of—"
"It's already through,"
she interrupted.
"And then leave us for a while. And if Koffler is out there, send him home."
"Certainly, sir."
Sessions desperately wanted to climb into bed and the shower, and not necessarily in that order, but he knew that would have to wait until Pickering finished whatever he had in mind. Pickering puffed thoughtfully on his cigar until the coffee was delivered and the buffet and dirty dishes removed.
"Are you going to want me for this, sir?" McCoy asked, starting to rise out of his chair. "Stick around, Ken. And you too, George."
McCoy lowered himself back into his chair and reached for the silver coffee pot.
"One more time, Ed," Pickering said to Sessions. "Both you and Rickaby are favorably impressed with Major Brownlee."
"Yes, sir. I suppose you could say he's everything Captain Macklin is not."
"I would have liked to make the judgment on my own," Pickering said. "But your opinion and Colonel Rickaby's is the next best thing. And I want this in place before they get here. You said tomorrow morning, right?"
"Yes, sir. They had seats on today's plane, but maybe sooner if Major Brownlee was able to get the Army Air Corps to carry them on a B-17.
"Okay. The participation of the OSS, which means Major Brownlee and Captain Macklin, in the mission to have a look at General Fertig and his guerrilla operation has been directed. That's a given. That poses certain problems, but also resolves some."
"Yes, sir?"
"For one thing, it may solve the radio operator problem. Against my better judgment, I agreed to let Koffler go with McCoy."
He looked at McCoy and saw in his eyes that he didn't like that at all.
"He's a hell of a radio operator, Ken. And there is apparently some way one radio operator can recognize another radio operator. I think they say every operator has a hand that's unlike anyone else's."
McCoy exhaled audibly and shrugged his acceptance of that. That was valuable. If the Japanese captured the new encryption device and they attempted to send deceptive information, for example, ordering the submarine to appear at a location where it would find a Japanese destroyer waiting for it, the receiving operator would be immediately suspicious if the correctly encrypted message was not in Koffler's hand.
"I have discussed this mission with General MacArthur, including the participation of the OSS,"
Pickering went on. He saw the surprise in Sessions' eyes.
That surprises you, Ed?
Yes, sir,
Sessions said.
Because you believe that Colonel Donovan, and for that matter, Secretary Knox, and for all we know, the President himself, would prefer that General MacArthur had no knowledge of OSS participation until the mission is over?
Yes, sir. I saw the special channel personal from Secretary Knox to you, sir. With respect, sir, they seem to spell that out pretty clearly.
I'm just a simple civilian in uniform, Captain Sessions, a former enlisted man. If it was bad judgment on my part to make the Supreme Commander, Sweepo, aware of a mission contemplated for execution within his area of responsibility, and if this comes to the attention of Secretary Knox, I don't give much of a damn whether Bill Donovan likes it or not, then the Secretary will have to take the action against me that he deems appropriate.
Yes, sir, Sessions said.
General MacArthur graciously offered any assistance he personally and Supreme Headquarters Sweepo can provide to help me in the execution of this mission, and I intend to ask him for a qualified high-speed radio operator. It seems entirely likely to me that among those who escaped from the Philippines, there should be such a person, probably a senior non-commissioned officer who also speaks Spanish, and thus would be even more highly qualified than our own Staff Sergeant Koffler.
Pickering now saw approval in McCoy's eyes.
I have also decided to remove Lieutenant McCoy from the roster of officers who will participate in this mission. I have several reasons for so doing, which I am, of course, prepared to defend to Secretary Knox. For one thing, there is the consideration of space available on the submarine. The fewer personnel, obviously, the more medical supplies the initial party can take with them. And finally, Lieutenant McCoy is not only the junior of the officers, but he has not been able to avail himself of the splendid training Bill Donovan provides for his agents.
General, Ed Sessions said, smiling broadly, at the risk of sounding like a toady, may I say that I wholeheartedly agree with the General's reasoning?
Yes, you may, Pickering said, chuckling, and then turned to McCoy. You have any problems with this, Ken?
Three, sir, McCoy said immediately, surprising Pickering.
Okay, Pickering said, making a let's-have-them gesture with his hand.
From personal experience, and I think Captain Sessions will go along with me on this, Macklin is a hell of a load to put on this major's shoulders.
Sessions' smile vanished.
Captain Macklin has to go, Ken, Pickering said. That's out of my hands.
McCoy nodded, then said, Zimmerman. It's a dirty trick to play on Zimmerman.
Christ, Sessions said. He had not thought of Zimmerman.
First of all, Pickering said, no one seems to know where Gunny Zimmerman is, except with the 2nd Raider Battalion somewhere behind the Jap lines on Guadalcanal. It's entirely possible that he won't arrive in Australia until after this mission has been mounted. And if he does show up, it is entirely possible that he will be suffering from malaria. I have been informed that 70-odd% of the 1st Marine Division has it, and if that's true, he will, of course, require hospitalization, and for a month or 6 weeks. By then, the mission will have been mounted.
McCoy shrugged and nodded, and then went on.
Furtick, sending Macklin seems to be a dirty trick to play on him.
I've thought about that. That's out of my hands, too. Anyway, if Major Brownlee is as good as Sessions and Rickaby seem to think, he should be able to handle Captain Macklin. Anything else?
No, sir, McCoy said.
You're not getting out of hazardous service, Ken, if that's what you're thinking. As soon as we do, you do, everything possible to ensure that Major Brownlee has everything he needs, and this mission is underway, I'm going to send you back to the States to rejoin the Mongolia operation.
Aye, aye, sir, McCoy said.
Okay, Pickering said. Unless anyone has something else, that's it. You get some sleep, Ed. You obviously need it. And you, Ken, start doing what has to be done to help Major Brownlee.
2. Water Lily Cottage, Brisbane, Australia. 1305 hours, 24 November 1942.
This thing is really primitive, isn't it?
Major Han Song-Du, Signal Corps, USA, said wonderingly as he examined the device cryptographic M94 on the dining room table. Sitting around the table were Colonel Jack N.M.I. Stecker
Major Hahn, Captain Edward Sessions, First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, Second Lieutenant John Marston Moore, and Staff Sergeant Stephen M. Koffler. Everyone was equipped with a pad of notepaper, pencils, and a coffee cup and saucer. In the middle of the table were two silver coffee pots. McCoy was puffing, blowing smoke rings, on a thin black cigar. Hahn thought it was a symbol, unconscious on McCoy's part, of where he stood in the estimation of General Pickering. Good cigars were in very short supply in Australia. Pickering had obtained 24 boxes of first-class, long, thin, black Philippine cigars from the master of a Pacific and Far East freighter that had called at Brisbane. They were being smoked by the Supreme Commander, Sweepo, General Pickering himself, and First Lieutenant K.R. McCoy.
"You really never saw one of them before, sir?"
Captain Edward Sessions, USMC, asked, surprised.
"Not even in a museum," Pluto replied. "And you can. What is it you jarheads say, McCoy? Belay that sir business."
"Watch that jarhead business, Major," Colonel Stecker said sternly, but with a smile. "Screw you, Major Dogface, sir," McCoy said. Stecker laughed out loud.
"Okay," Pluto said. "Just to set the priorities, the expert here is Koffler, since he has been on the receiving end of a homemade SOI before."
A signal operating instruction specified which one of a large number of available codes was to be used at specific times and dates.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Pluto," Stecker said. "What's a homemade SOI?
"In any SOI," Pluto said, "it is presumed both parties to the encryption processes have access to the same symbol..."
"Symbols?
What symbols?" McCoy asked, confused.
"When A equals X, A is the symbol for X. Okay?"
"Got it."
"Colonel," Pluto said, "to resume the answer I was giving before being so rudely interrupted by Lieutenant McCoy, before we sent McCoy and Hart into Buka, we had to presume A, that the Japanese were intercepting the radio traffic between here and Buka. B, that the SOI that Koffler was using was no longer secure, and it followed that C, the Japanese were decrypting our traffic. It followed from that that if we used the existing SOI to inform Buka when and where we were going to land McCoy and Hart on Buka, we would also be informing the Japanese. So we had to get Koffler a new SOI, which meant a homemade SOI." "How did you do that?" Stecker asked.
Hahn waved at Second Lieutenant Moore.
We devised a simple code, Colonel, using symbols known to both us and the Coast Watchers on Buka, but not to the Japanese," Moore explained. "Specifically, we used some, rather intimate biographical data."
"And that worked, Koffler, right?" Pluto asked.
"It worked. We had a hell of a hard time figuring some of it out, but it worked."
"What does that mean, intimate biographical data?" Stecker asked. "Take a look at these, Colonel," Moore said, as he dug in his briefcase and came up with a thin sheaf of 3x5-inch cards. He walked around the table to Stecker and laid the cards before Stecker. Koffler got up and went to Stecker, and after a moment, so did McCoy and Sessions. A moment later, they were all looking over Stecker's shoulder. "The first card is the first paragraph of the message we sent to Koffler," Moore explained. "We used the old code because we didn't want to admit to the Japanese we knew they had broken it. Use as simple substitution, X, Juliet's name, X, Romeo's name, X, what she thought he had when they met, X, name of test, X, result of test, X."
"What's this Romeo and Juliet business?" Stecker asked.
Pluto turned from helping himself to a cup of coffee.
"As we understood it, Colonel," he said, dry amusement in his thick Boston MIT accent, "the great romance between Lieutenant Howard, Romeo, and Juliet, Lieutenant J.G. Barbara Carter of the Navy Nurse Corps, began at the Navy Hospital, San Diego, when he went for a blood test. The Marine Corps wanted to make sure he did not have syphilis before they made him an officer. Since Miss Carter, to whom he went to be tested, did not at first know the purpose of the Wasserman test, she treated him accordingly. As a social pariah,
so to speak. But love at first sight triumphed in the end.
Stecker laughed.
Really? We believed it was an occasion he would remember, Pluto said.
What you do for simple substitution, Moore went on, is write the symbols without spaces in a line. He exposed the second 3x5 card. Under a line of numbers from which the decimal digit after the first 9 digits has been dropped. The card bore the digits 1 through 0, repeated 3 times, plus the digits 1 through 8, under which were letters spelling out Barbara, Joseph, Syphilis, Wasserman, negative.
Okay, Stecker said.
Card 3 is the simple substitution encrypted message, Moore said, and flipped it over. The card showed corresponding numbers substituted for letters. Card 4 shows the decryption, Moore said, and flipped the last card over. It was obviously of a personal nature. The decoded card read, I love ya Joe, Barbara, Ra, Anna. Same, Steve, Baffney.
So I see, Stecker said, smiling.
What we're going to try to do here today is set up the same sort of thing to communicate with General Fertig, Pluto said, so that we can let him know to expect the people from the OSS and possibly General Pickering wants to talk about this to Commander Felt and Colonel Dupre before he decides when and where they will land from the submarine.
Okay, Stecker said.
There's an additional problem here, Pluto said. We only have intimate personal data on General Fertig himself. We have virtually nothing on the army officers with him. Not only were their records apparently destroyed at the time of surrender, but any dependents are now either dead or interned. In any event, they are not available to help, as Mrs. Fertig is in Colorado. In the presumption that the Japanese will break our simple substitution rather quickly, we are reluctant to use more of General Fertig's personal data than we absolutely have to. If we do, the Japanese will be able to build a dossier on him we don't want them to have.
What about the Marines? Stecker asked.
We have their names, Pluto said. Right here, Moore chimed in, dipping into his briefcase again. But they're not of much use, Pluto continued. With the exception of the pilot, they're all former enlisted members of the 4th Marines, all unmarried according to the Marine Corps in Washington, and all of them have listed their official home of record as Care of Headquarters, USMC, Washington, D.C. I found that a little strange.
You do that, Pluto, if you don't have a home, McCoy said. Or you have a home, you'd just as soon forget.
Hahn had the sudden insight that the official records of Lieutenant K.R. McCoy listed C.O. Headquarters, USMC, Washington, D.C., as his home of record.
What about the pilot? Stecker asked.
They generally keep more extensive records on officers than they do on enlisted men.
Unmarried, Moore interjected, consulting a sheet of paper. His parents are dead. He listed his next of kin as an aunt. ONI contacted her. She hasn't seen him in 10 years.
You have the names of the enlisted men? McCoy asked.
I used to be in the 4th.
So did I, Colonel Stecker said, and put out his hand. Moore handed him 2 typewritten sheets of paper. He ran his finger down the names on one page and then turned to the second.
I know this character, he said. Professional private. Hell of a Marine, 28 days a month. Then forget him for 3 days until he's blown his pay.
Do you think he has a family? Pluto asked.
No, Stecker chuckled wryly. And I really doubt if he'd remember me.
He handed the sheets of paper to McCoy. Almost immediately, McCoy said,
I know this guy. Mean son of a bitch.
You're sure, Ken?
There aren't very many Marines named Percy, McCoy said, and then his memory cleared.
Christ! If I'm right, this guy worked for Banning after I left China.
He raised his eyes to Pluto.
How quick could we get an answer from Banning if we asked him?
Using the special channel, we can have an answer in 24 hours, maybe less, Moore said.
How often are we in contact with Fertig? McCoy asked.
Once a day in the morning, Pluto said.
But I think they monitor all the time. You want to try to call them?
I want to ask Banning if this is the same Percy, McCoy said, and try to talk to Percy.
I'm sure General Pickering will authorize use of the special channel, Colonel Stecker said. You mean now, Ken? Pluto asked. Before we go on with this?
McCoy didn't answer. He walked back to his seat, picked up his pencil, and began to print characters on the pad of paper.
What are you doing, Ken?
Sessions asked. McCoy's left hand waved in a don't-bother-me-now gesture. Pluto looked at Stecker, who shrugged and held both hands palm up in a let's-see-what-he's-up-to gesture. 2 minutes later, McCoy pushed the pad to Pluto.
What can you spell with that alphabet, Pluto?
McCoy asked.
The line on top.
Pluto looked at the sheet of paper. The letters A-C-D-E-H-I-L-M-N-O-P-R-S-U-X-Y were printed there. Underneath was the name from which those letters had been derived, Quentin Alexander McPherson.
There's no W, no Y, Pluto said.
It's got all the vowels, McCoy argued.
Okay, Pluto said. Using obvious substitution, M for W, U for V, etc., it would be useful. Slide me that, please,
Colonel Stecker ordered, his curiosity aroused. He read it, then looked at McCoy.
Who is Quentin Alexander McPherson? He asked.
Looking quite pleased with himself, McCoy smiled at Stecker.
I thought of this when you said you'd been with the 4th Marines.
Gunny, Stecker, he said.
He stood up, put his hands on his hips, thrust out his stomach, and in a harsh, guttural mimicry announced,
The next time one of you swine think yous can ruin my VD record by bringing some amoral, slant-eyed, diseased Chinese bimbo into my barracks, I will cut your tallywhacker off with a dull bayonet and shove it down your throat, or my name ain't Quentin Alexander McPherson.
Stecker chuckled.
Oh, yes, he said. I remember First Sergeant McPherson.
If Pluto's Sergeant Percy Everly is my Percy Everly, McCoy went on, the one thing about his service with Baker Company, 1st Battalion, 4th Marines that he will never forget is First Sergeant Quentin Alexander McPherson. And if he remembers him, he'll remember Zimmerman, too. He made the mistake of taking him on. Top Secret, Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, Navy Department, Washington, D.C., via special channel duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. For Colonel F. L. Rickaby, Chief USMC Office of Management Analysis, Brisbane, Australia, Monday, 23 November, 1942. Dear Fritz, because of a priority problem at Pearl Harbor, Sessions and supplies arrived alone this morning. Major Brownlee and Captain Macklin expected here on following plane tomorrow morning. Will advise. McCoy believes Sergeant Percy L. Everly with Fertig may have served with Banning in 4th Marines. If this is so, it is extremely important that Banning furnish immediately, repeat immediately, whatever personal information Ray Everly Banning feels might be valuable in establishing SOI of type used vis-a-vis Howard and Koffler. Despite the high regard with which everyone in the Naval Service seems to regard Captain Macklin, I have been wondering why he is a captain and McCoy isn't. Please see what you can do about this. Regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General, USMCR. Top Secret. 3. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 0810 hours, 24 November, 1942.
Come up, gentlemen, please,
Brigadier General Wendell W. Fertig, Commanding General, USFIP, said, making the appropriate gesture with his hand. He was sitting at a rattan table on the veranda of his headquarters, a thatched roof building on stilts built against a hill. Second Lieutenant Robert Ball, the USFIP signal officer, and his chief radio operator, Sergeant Ignacio Lamadrid, Philippine Army, who had been standing near the top of the ladder-like steps to the veranda, climbed the rest of the way up. Both saluted, and Fertig returned the salute.
We've got a message from Australia, sir, Ball said. It doesn't make a lot of sense. They rarely do they, Lieutenant? Fertig said, and put his hand out to take the sheet of paper in Ball's hand.
It appeared to be a carbon copy of a decrypted message, but it was, in fact, the original. Though two typewriters, 8 reams of typewriter paper, and a ream of carbon paper had been acquired from the basement of the ruins of the burned Manuel Quezon Primary School, for the use of headquarters, USFIP, neither had a ribbon. It was consequently necessary to make a paper-carbon paper sandwich to type anything on the ribbonless machines. The original looked like a carbon.
"It's longer than usual, isn't it?"
Fertig said as he began to read.
"Yes, sir," Ball agreed.
The great bulk of their traffic from Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, was usually very brief. "Your request being considered," or various paraphrases all meaning the same thing, "we're still thinking about whether or not we're going to help you." The message read, GYB to MFS. Using full, repeat, full name of first dog, Baker, fourth, repeat, Baker, fourth, send last, repeat, last name, motor sergeant, missionary rescue convoy, GYB standing by.
"What the hell does this mean?"
Fertig asked, baffled. Lieutenant Ball and Sergeant La Madrid responded with a shrug.
"Sergeant, would you please ask Captains Weston and Buchanan to join us?"
General Fertig ordered.
"Yes, sir,"
La Madrid said, saluted, and went back down the ladder. Captains Buchanan and Weston appeared several minutes later. Captain Buchanan was freshly shaved and was wearing a neat khaki uniform. He had even hemmed the trousers and sleeves where they had been cut off. Captain Weston was wearing a pith helmet with a Marine Corps insignia, baggy and somewhat soiled loose white cotton garments of local manufacture, and a full beard.
"I believe, sir, they're after a simple substitution code," Buchanan offered. "In other words, if we have the full name they mention, we use that to construct a simple substitution code."
"What name?"
"First sergeants are called first dogs," Buchanan said.
"That could mean Baker Company of the 4th Marines, sir,"
Weston offered, becoming convinced as he spoke that that was exactly what it meant.
"We sent out Everly's name. He was in the 4th Marines."
"Where is he?"
"Not here, sir. He took a patrol out toward Bunawan."
"And won't be back,"
Fertig said, chagrined that he had forgotten he had ordered a patrol himself.
"Until... when? Day after tomorrow?"
No, sir," Buchanan said. "Not until Friday, 27 November, if everything goes well."
"Can we send a runner after him?"
Fertig wondered aloud.
"Well, yes, sir, we could," Buchanan said, his tone making it perfectly clear he thought this would be ill-advised.
"Okay, where are we?" Fertig asked. "It is your opinion, gentlemen, that we need a code based on a name which might be that of a first sergeant in the 4th Marines, and that name might, just might, be known to Lieutenant Everly, because he served with the 4th Marines?"
"What about the other Marines?" Lieutenant Ball asked.
"They're with Everly," Buchanan said.
"Damn!"
Fertig said. He exhaled audibly, then bent over the rattan table and wrote out the reply of Headquarters USFIP to the message from Supreme Headquarters SWEPO. He wrote, using very small letters. When the 4 reams of typewriter paper from the Manuel Quezon Elementary School were exhausted, he had no idea where they were going to get more. MFS to GYB. Regret tactical operations preclude response to your 24 November message prior to 27 November. Communications between our headquarters would be greatly facilitated if supply of typewriter ribbons could be included in next, which, of course, would be first supply shipment. End. Fertig, Brig Gen Commanding. 4. Signal Section, Office of the Military Governor for Mindanao, Cagayan de Oro, Misami, Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 1305 hours, 25 November, 1942. Lieutenant Hideyori rose from behind his desk and bowed as Captain Matsuo Saikaku walked in.
"I would have been happy, sir, to have brought this to your office."
"Not a problem, Hideyori. This was quicker. I have my Lincoln V-12, you know."
"I called as soon as the decryption came in from Signals Intelligence, sir," Hideyori said, handing Saikaku a single sheet of paper. "GYB, sir, is the call sign, one of the call signs of American headquarters in Australia."
"Yes, so you have told me," Saikaku said, somewhat impatiently.
He looked at the message.
GYB to MFS, using full, repeat, full name of first dog Baker, fourth, repeat, Baker, fourth, send last, repeat, last name, motor sergeant, missionary, rescue convoy, GYB standing by. The second read, MFS to GYB. Regret, tactical operations preclude response to your 24 November message prior to 27 November. Communications between our headquarters would be greatly facilitated if supply of typewriter ribbons could be included in next, which of course would be first supply shipment. And, Fertig, Brig Gen Commanding. After reading both messages, he asked,
Presumably this copy is for me?
Yes, sir.
Did Signals Intelligence offer anything that would make sense of this?
No, sir, Hideyori replied. All they offered in amplification was that this was encrypted on the same U.S. Army device.
Has there been anything else?
No, sir.
Make sure your operators are specially alert on 27 November, Hideyori, for Fatigue's reply.
Yes, sir, I will.
And call me, no matter the hour, if there are any developments at all.
Yes, sir, I will.
Captain Saikaku got back in his Lincoln and drove to the house behind the wall. The sergeant and his young Filipino friend were sitting side by side, eating a pineapple on their bed, a mattress laid against the wall. They both looked at him with fear in their eyes as they jumped to their feet. As they had been taught to do, they bowed to him from the waist.
"I am having some slight difficulty with American vernacular," Captain Saikaku announced. "Perhaps you will be good enough to assist me."
"Yes, sir, of course."
"What does the phrase Baker Fourth mean?"
In the fear in the sergeant's eyes, Saikaku read his answer before he gave it.
"I don't think I know, sir."
"What about first dog?"
The sergeant's eyes again showed fear and incomprehension.
"I don't know, sir."
"That is unfortunate," Saikaku said. "I thought you were beginning to understand the benefits of cooperation with me."
Captain, maybe if you showed me that?"
the sergeant said. Saikaku carefully creased off the upper portion of the page and then carefully tore it off. Now there was a sign of relief in the sergeant's eyes.
"I think I know what this means," he said. "They sometimes call the first sergeant of a company first dog."
"The first sergeant? The senior non-commissioned officer?"
"Yes, sir, sometimes that's what they are called."
"Is it disrespectful?"
"Yes, sir, it is. And Baker Fourth probably means Baker Company, B Company of the Fourth something."
"Fourth something?"
"Some kind of a battalion, sir, like the Fourth Signal Battalion or the Fourth Quartermaster Battalion."
"Were there such units here?"
The fear returned to the sergeant's eyes.
"I don't remember, sir."
"You don't remember, or you don't want to tell me?"
"If I knew, I would tell you, sir."
"Can you help me with the second part of the message? Were you familiar with any missionary rescue mission?"
"No, sir. I saw that, sir, and thought about it. I was in personnel, sir. I wouldn't know about things like that. That would be considered an operation, sir, and personnel never gets involved."
"I know people, Sergeant, who enjoy praying with your friend. Sometimes, when you have been cooperative, I am motivated to discourage them."
"Being as cooperative as I can, sir. I really am."
"He looks as if he is about to weep. He is an utterly despicable parody of a man." "I don't know how I feel about you right now," Saikaku said, "whether you are being cooperative or not. I will have to think about it."
He turned and walked out of the bedroom. He thought he would order the Filipino deviant to be beaten, but decided against it. The fear of a beating, he decided, would probably be more useful than another beating. He returned to his office and told his sergeant to search through the index of captured American documents and prepare a list of every American or Filipino Army unit designated by the Arabic numeral 4. 5. Top Secret, Headquarters USMC Washington, Supreme Commander Sweepo, Eyes Only, Brig Gen F.W. Pickering, USMCR, 0705, 25 November, 1942. Via Special Channel, Duplication Forbidden, Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. 1. Percy Lewis Everly, 4th Marines, worked for me subsequent departure from China of Sessions, McCoy, and Zimmerman. 2. Everly's hometown, Zanesville, West Virginia. Sergeant John V. Casey dispatched Zanesville immediately on receipt your message to develop further biographic details. 3. Believe Everly will remember maiden name of my wife, Ludmilla Zhivkov. 4. Trying to recall from memory name Everly's Chinese wife. 5. Regret sparseness of information available. More will follow as developed. Banning, Major USMC. Top secret. 6. Naval Air Transport Passenger Terminal, Brisbane, Australia. 0715 hours, 26 November 1942. Captain Robert B. Macklin, USMC, was rather pleased that things had turned out as they did, even if it meant his arrival in Brisbane was delayed an additional 24 hours. At Hickam Field, Major Brownlee succeeded in finding space for himself aboard a B-17, one of a flight of 7 bound for Australia via Midway Island. But that was only possible because one of the plane's crewmen was taken unexpectedly ill, and the decision was made to continue without him. There was no space for Macklin, which meant that after he saw Major Brownlee off, he returned to Pearl Harbor and a very nice steak dinner at the Pearl Harbor Officers Club and a comfortable bed in the BOQ. When he reported the next morning to the Pearl Harbor Naval Air Transport Passenger Terminal, Lieutenant J.G. L.B. Cavanaugh, the officer in charge passenger seat assignment, told him there would be an additional delay. The plane on which he was scheduled to fly to Brisbane, Cavanaugh explained, had encountered some really bad weather on the way into Pearl Harbor from Midway. It had been temporarily removed from service so that the amount of damage, if any, it had suffered could be ascertained and, if necessary, repaired. The entire passenger roster was therefore set back 24 hours, Cavanaugh said. That meant a day on the beach and another dinner at the officers' club. A luau, complete to the whole roasted pig, and another night in a comfortable BOQ bed. The only thing wrong with the evening was that the Navy nurse he met at the bar almost laughed at him when he suggested they go to his BOQ. After letting him charm her and feed her drinks for hours, teasing him, rubbing her body against him while they danced. The next morning, the damage, if any, was apparently repaired and the Coronado took off on schedule. The seat wasn't all that comfortable, but it was certainly more comfortable than anything the B-17 Flying Fortress had offered Major Brownlee, and the flight was as pleasant as could be. After hearing what had happened 2 days before to the inbound Coronado, he had worried about the weather, but there was none. The Pacific was really Pacific, with hardly a cloud in the sky on both legs, Hawaii Midway and Midway Brisbane. After the whaleboats transported them from the seaplane to the quay, and he climbed the stone stairs set in the face of the quay, he was met by a Marine staff sergeant. He looked like a child, and Macklin wondered what fool of a commanding officer had agreed to his promotion. "Captain Macklin?" the boy-faced sergeant asked. "Yes, I am." "Staff Sergeant Coffler, sir. If you'll point out your gear to me, I'll get it. The 2 bags with my name on them on the steps. Make sure they don't get away from you." "No sweat, sir. The major's over there, sir," Coffler said, and pointed.
"What did you say, Sergeant?"
"I said, the major's over there, sir, in the Studebaker. I meant before that. Did you really say, no sweat, to me?"
"Yes, sir, I guess I did."
"The correct response to an order, Sergeant, is aye-aye, sir."
"Aye-aye, sir," Coffler said. He looked amused.
"Did I say something amusing, Sergeant?"
"No, sir."
"Then wipe that smile off your face."
"Aye, aye, sir."
As he approached the Studebaker, a very large Oriental, the largest Macklin could ever remember seeing, in the uniform of an Army Signal Corps major, stepped out of the front passenger seat. Macklin saluted. The major made a vague gesture toward his head that only generously could be interpreted as a salute.
"Ah, you must be Macklin," the major said, in a heavy Bostonian accent.
"I am Captain Macklin.
Where's the major?"
"Excuse me?"
"Where is Major Brownlee?"
"You mean he's not here?"
"If he was here, Captain, I wouldn't have asked where he is," Pluto replied.
Sir, may I ask who you are? My name is Han, Pluto said. Have you any idea, Captain, where Major Brownlee is?
With all respect, sir, I am on a classified mission, and until...
I know all about your mission, Captain.